So welcome to all of you, and welcome especially to the graduating class of 2015. I've got a special feeling about that since I graduated last year. They didn't call mine a graduation, they called it retirement. They don't call yours graduation either, they call it commencement. Retirement, commencement, graduation, what do they share? I'd like to claim that each of these terms carries within it, latently, something of its opposite numbers. And I'll be talking today about how your commencement is inevitably an ending. And I want to start by telling you briefly how my ending, not quite, but you know what retirement portends, how my ending carried within it some surprising beginnings. Here's some of what I discovered this past year in life after Swarthmore. So point one, Abu Dhabi. NYU has been developing for the past 6 years a university campus in Abu Dhabi. I think you know about this. The man who runs that campus is Al Bloom, formerly our president. I was invited to teach for a semester in their new program. Although every now and then someone with whom I shared this news expressed enthusiasm, 3 out of every 4 people looked on it askance. Never mind that the Sheikh of Abu Dhabi, sitting on 9% of the world's known oil reserves, is seeking to modernize his Arab country. One way he's doing this is asking NYU to develop a liberal arts institution on UAE soil, one with students from all over the world. In my course of 13 students, no two were from the same country. The English they spoke was a rainbow coalition of how English can be spoken, but they spoke it vigorously, along with often 3 or 4 other languages they were proficient in. And I knew this would be a remarkable experience. Yet most of my friends and family were anxious. With the name of Weinstein, they reckoned, they might hear about me next on TV in a horrifying, garish way. Casualty of ISIS savagery, more generally, victim of Middle Eastern inhospitality. It did not help matters when a few weeks before my wife and I headed for Abu Dhabi, the newspapers released a story that stoked everyone's worst fears. A woman dressed from head to foot in a flowing black abaya, only her eyes were visible, had entered one of Abu Dhabi's bustling new malls, made her way to a lady's lavatory, and knifed to death a young American woman who had the bad luck to be in the same place at the same time. All of this was silently and breathtakingly tracked by mall security cameras. You could not take your eyes off that flowing black abaya. The killer, who did not know her victim, then headed out to her parked car, apparently in search of other victims, perhaps American ones. Within hours, she was caught by the Abu Dhabi police, and no further information about her is available. Her real motives were not known then. They are not known now. Those are the facts. But here are the facts' embellishment and reverberations. As headline news, the story seemed to confirm for countless Western readers the latent barbarity of the Middle East. They are not like us. Their civility is only skin deep. Further down, they carry a knife. Maybe they hate us. This brutal narrative was never cited in the newspaper reports, but it spread like wildfire, and it infected me and my wife. For our first 3 weeks in Abu Dhabi, our hearts were in our hands if we had to use a public toilet, especially one in a city mall. And the black abaya, worn in this part of the world by untold numbers of women, became for us a sinister sign: oppression, concealment, barbarity. Over time, we began to educate ourselves. We learned that this murder was extraordinarily rare, that the officials of Abu Dhabi were as amazed by it as the Western world was. And we realized that knife murders in any American capital, in mall bathrooms or on the streets, occur much more often. Too often, in fact, to be big news. You'll find them on the back pages of the paper. And you might lament the violence, but you won't fear for your life. Why not? And why did we in Abu Dhabi? Among the reasons you won't fear for your life is that you know so much more about American life. You have so much more experience of it. You know soothing counter-narratives, like, we have violence, but most of us are nonviolent. And if you are minimally careful about where you go and when you go there, you're unlikely to get hurt. We tend to believe this in an unthinking way, despite the data showing that a knife attack is a lot more likely in urban America than in Abu Dhabi. This was the moment when I recognized that my fear in Abu Dhabi was rooted in the exotic stories I carried inside myself about the Middle East. Abu Dhabi, the larger UAE, Saudi Arabia, Qatar, Oman, Kuwait, Jordan, Lebanon, they were all vaguely tarred with the same narrative brush, all of them part of that unknown and unreliable part of the world we call the Middle East. I was drawing on narratives, not experience. I had been trusting the narratives as though they were roughly reliable. This one was not. At this realization, I had a larger one: how unfamiliar we all are with most of this great world. Indeed, it's a lifelong scandal, the ratio between the little bit of the world we actually understand and the huge portions of it we know very little about. All we have about what we have not experienced are narratives. We want to assume that they are roughly co-equal with experience. But the truth may be that each of us is stuffed full of stories, mildly to grossly inadequate, about the places and cultures we do not know. Not only stories passed on to us by our culture and our friends, also the ones we read about in the New York Times. The author of that headline piece in the Times was never going to write with equal emphasis that this kind of violence is virtually unheard of in Abu Dhabi. The visual emphasis would be on the woman's TV-caught, flowing black abaya. The verbal emphasis would be on the murderous act itself, the unspoken message being, this could happen to you if you travel there. Newspapers have to sell copy, and despite their fact-checking, they batten on dramatic stories. What could be more dramatic than such a killing? In time, I would learn that black abayas come in every conceivable form and style, some of them exquisitely decorated, drop-dead gorgeous. I put the phobia of the black abaya to bed, perhaps a month later, when in one of the New York University Abu Dhabi recreation lounges, I stood and watched three young Arab students, all of them in black abayas, playing a spirited game of pool. Their robes were open and flying in all directions. The cue sticks were cocked at crazily different angles. They cackled and crowed as they sank a ball or missed it entirely. And as I looked on, the abaya finally escaped the narrative I had been laboring under. It was just the garb these women were culturally trained to wear. It did not keep them from the pleasures of Western pool. One more event from my semester in the Middle East. Because we were able to, we traveled twice to a country so far away, we'd given up on ever visiting it: India. While there, we found ourselves discussing with natives a topic I thought I had nothing to learn about: arranged marriages. Nothing to learn, because I knew in my bones that modern cultures no longer taught such practices. Indeed, arranged marriages seemed to me proof positive of unenlightenment. So I was unprepared for the talk we had with two young doctors from Kochi, male and female, who had been in charge of the Ayurvedic massages my wife and I had just received. In fluent English, they explained to us that their marriage had been arranged 5 years earlier, but that they would not have gone through with it if they had initially disliked each other. More, the astrology cards and the differences in caste played into the eventuality of their marriage. If the cards had been wholly against them, they'd have given up. But the cards were mildly supportive, that is, the astrological negatives were open to massage, that other kind of massage. It was the caste difference they were still working out, less between the two of them than with their two sets of parents. Astrology? Caste? Arranged marriages? Yet this couple seemed sane, thoughtful, in love with each other, gracious, and informed about their own feelings, their families, and their culture. Their thinking was echoed several weeks later in Mumbai in a conversation with our young Hindi guide. He lived deliberately in one of the Mumbai slums, very inexpensive and well-run lodging, it turns out. We had to rethink what slums can mean as well. In his mid-20s, fairly successful in his job as guide, he thought it was time to get married, and he set his mother to thinking about the task. She is well-networked, and she has the time, while he labors to improve his finances, to find a suitable girl. If he doesn't like her first choice, he'll take a look at her second choice. He won't marry just to please her, but he's persuaded that she has his best interests at heart, she understands him, and she'll do the job well. He'll save time that way. Well, my wife and I were fairly speechless during both these discussions. And I began to ask myself, why did I find arranged marriages anathema? In pursuing this question, I came to grasp better the cultural logic of my own marriage and of dominant American notions about marriage. Choosing a partner is one of the cardinal ways young Americans demonstrate their freedom from their parents, indeed their freedom as such. It feels like a sacred individual right, but if you press, you find that it's cultural to the hilt. The right to choose on our own, to differ from our parents, to live elsewhere, do a different kind of work, move out of their orbit, and found our own. This is as familiar as Romeo and Juliet and West Side Story, and we glory in this narrative, its way of celebrating our independence from family or class or religion. Growing up Jewish, I chose to marry a young woman who had grown up Episcopalian, and we married on the premise that our romance was sacred and ours alone. And such thinking is oppositional to the core. Parents, lovely though they be, do not understand us, especially if they do not understand our passions. This choice is ours, not theirs. We'll go to the wall to make good on it. Well, what parents in this audience have not seen these stark differences soften over time? That either us or them insistence transforms over the years as parents become grandparents and the binary model becomes tripartite. And the young couple realize gradually that their parents are not their opposites, but a mere generation older. Versions of themselves, after all, even as the children to come, and the grandchildren after them, will be different mainly generationally, intricately shared likenesses and differences, come to replace replace that earlier shrill insistence on opposition. Something it now seems to me that Indian cultures may have figured out as well centuries earlier and kept as cultural resource, not cultural primitivism. It took me until my retirement to learn this. The next points are all briefer. Here's the first one. You cannot predict the future. Hans Oberdieck gave the baccalaureate address last year, and he began with a powerful instance of this reality. He spoke of Swarthmore's class of 1914, graduating 100 years before that present class of 2014. In hindsight, we can see what that class 100 years ago was headed for. The disaster of the 1914-1918 war, the devastating Spanish flu that came shortly after. In late May or June of 1914, what could that graduating class know about the guns of August? No less, none of you knows for sure what's coming down the pike this August. It has not yet arrived. This humiliating reality that in crucial ways we remain helpless in the face of a future that has not yet arrived cannot be gainsaid. And what does this reality, the opacity of the future, say about your education and your graduation? For starters, you probably cannot predict the job you'll find most satisfaction in, or how many jobs you'll move through before you find the right one. More, you probably can't predict the partner you'll marry or care for most in life, and you likewise can't predict whether that union will survive or not. No less, you do not know where you'll end up living. So you really do not know much about what your life after Swarthmore is going to be. Now, how crazy is that? Hundreds of thousands of dollars have been spent on your 4 years here, yet many of you are feeling, and rightly so, more exposed to the unknown than you've been in a long time. Because this is so, it follows that these 4 years here are not and cannot be about arming you for your future, enabling you to know in advance what it's going to be like. Your liberal arts education cannot pretend to cheat the risk of time, cannot cheat the risk of time by giving you a sneak preview of the cards not yet played. Those cards are unknown. Your education, if it is liberal, is not a guessing game. So to repeat, these years have not been about predicting what you're going to do afterwards and preparing you rigorously to do it. Is this a scandalous claim? After all, most educational systems all over the world, and the great majority of them in this country too, do just that. That is the normative model. Post-secondary education prepares you for your professional working life. Such schools take you in as a prospective X, and for 2 or 3 or 4 years, they teach you what you need to know to become a successful X. In America, a small number of schools that we identify as our finest have made a different decision. Learning systematically how to do well the work you may spend the rest of your life doing is the task of graduate school, or of a different kind of undergraduate school, not of your 4 years at Swarthmore. These years are liberal, not professional. It's not clear what they prepare you to do. It's deliberately not clear. But I can point to what your liberal education has not been about. It's not about recuperating the vast amount of money spent on your education. You will recuperate it handsomely. Last year, the New York Times published studies showing that a college degree is worth at least $500,000 more in a lifetime than a high school degree. And doubtless the difference has increased since then. But your education is not about the money that it costs. It also is not modeled on the kind of progressive improvement embodied in your world of ever more masterful technological gadgetry. A new OS is indisputably more powerful and efficient than the one it replaces. The next generation of smartphones, unarguably smarter than the last one, demonstrably better and better. But that's not the model for your education here. I think you've been busy doing something else. Learning, trying to learn, how to think more critically, more creatively. Learning as well how to listen to yourself, how to map yourself in relation to all those maps of self and world that you have engaged throughout the curriculum. And this involves as well your developing relation to that inner voice you brought here 4 years ago and that you'll carry inside you until your dying day. It's always your voice, but I bet it's changed since September of your freshman year. What different vocabularies you're likely now to use when you talk silently to yourself. Know thyself. Socrates' dictum undergirds a huge portion of what you've come to understand better. And know the world. What is the curriculum but a set of invitations to think more intricately about this great world as engaged by countless selves, to be more than you were when you came here 4 years ago? I want to make another claim. Nothing abidingly valuable in your inner and shared lives can be proved. Many of you have spent a lot of time proving things in your courses, but your education isn't about proofs. The liberal arts are instead about trying things out, trying things on, seeing more deeply, more probingly. Your time here is experimental, but not about proofs. It's a time of emotional and intellectual experiment, trying out your possible selves, engaging with possible worlds, seeing which fits seem fruitful, let you see further. I myself have spent most of my life in that trying out territory that we call literature. The narratives I work with make imaginatively real situations that you can enter into deeply, yet without having to suffer their consequences. You can read Kafka and become transformed imaginatively into a gigantic insect without having to die of it, as Gregor Samsa does in The Metamorphoses. It's not just literature that's a trying out, but also physics and history and economics and dance, all the forms of study you've committed yourselves to. These 4 years have involved your opening yourself up to a wide range of theories and paradigms, pathways and problems, pursuits and questions, ways of using your mind and your heart to engage this great world. If your 4 years have been good, you now find the world a more complicated, more mysterious, and more challenging place than when you arrived as a freshman. Your time here has been a trying out. It could be your greatest trying out. My next point, finding things more interesting. Some years ago, at a meeting with prospective freshmen and their very anxious parents, a particularly concerned mother asked me, "If my son chooses to major in English, what good will it do him? Will it get him a good job? Will it allow him to avoid some of life's greater miseries, like divorce?" The job part was easier to answer than the divorce part. About the job, I said, our graduates do find jobs in many different fields, forms of creative writing, journalism, library work, publishing, various other forms of media, TV, online. Most of them do not go on to further degrees in English. Indeed, Our challenge as a department is to prepare the small number who do go on to do so competitively, and yet to make the major in English work be worthwhile for the majority who will never write another English paper. One way we do that is by helping them to write better, not English papers, but papers in English. They are probably going to write some version of papers in English for the rest of their lives, and they need to have command over the language to know what it says and what it doesn't say and what it has not earned the right to say if they are to swim successfully in English the rest of their lives. English, as the medium they function in, swim in. They will either use it well or find themselves used by it, misled by others' manipulation of it. We call this resource, which we labor here to teach to the parents' sons and daughters, we call it critical thinking. The capacity to grasp whether a proposition or premise is well-founded, the capacity to see what the proposition or premise may not want us to see. That was the easier answer. The harder part was the divorce. So I faced the music and I said to this anxious mother, I said, no, majoring in English will not make it less likely that your son's marriage will end in divorce. But we do hope that if it comes to that, his English major will make the divorce more interesting. That answer struck the mother as useless, maybe worse than useless. It might sound to you perverse as well. What's interesting about a divorce? Start to think about it, and a lot is interesting, like his role in what worked and what didn't, his parents' role in what worked, his partner's role in what worked and what didn't, how it might look to someone on the outside, interesting as bigger picture, interesting as breathing space, interesting as this mess I find myself in is not unique to me, it has happened to others. Literature is full of divorces. It can be learned about, it can be endured, it can be learned from. So point number three, I'd like to see you graduate from this place more capable of finding your scene interesting, able to see better what's at stake in your troubles, which isn't the same as avoiding them. Point number four, you are both creators and creatures. As I've been stressing, you've learned to do more things here, to grasp something of the generative logic of the disciplines you've studied, to understand better how language works, yours, that of others, to map out larger territories as physics and math and engineering map them, to recognize the intricacy of the living world as biology charts it, to understand the endlessly vexed social world as history and poli-sci and economics parse it. No less in the humanities, you've enlarged your grasp of what other humans, other cultures, have accomplished over time in music, art, and literature, how they've imagined themselves over time in religion and philosophy. You are larger for this attempt to grasp the bigger picture, and I think you are deeper for having thought as best you can about selves and worlds and how they mesh and how they don't. You can think and do so many more things than you could or even knew about when you arrived here 4 years ago. But you are also creatures. That is to say, as much as you have learned to master time, to turn these years into purpose and resource, you also remain caught up in time, remain time's creature. And this is the anxiety of graduation. Time weighs upon you on a day like this, as it has not for years. The masteries of your senior year have come to an end. Your world is going to have to begin again. commencement. How promising the word sounds when we think of it as the opposite of an ending. How daunting when we consider its other meaning. We must begin again. You must become again a beginner. How unfair is that? We are all immersed in time in ways that we never fully map or master. One of my favorite writers, Marcel Proust, captures eloquently our predicament, if it is not our comedy. He writes, "We become ourselves only in the course of time. On ne se réalise que successivement. All of us is never there all at once." And even now, at what feels like a moment bursting with ripeness, there is the memory of a high school graduation 4 years ago. There is the anticipation of a proving ground not yet arrived, but coming down the road 4 or 5 years from now. So you are here now, gloriously. And if you don't enjoy this part, you're missing something great. But you are also perhaps anxious today, and you have good reason. An ending supposes a beginning, a new one. This chapter concluding, I bet for most of you, has been a great one. What's next? On ne se réalise que successivement. You were just as real, though different, 4 years ago, as you are today. You will be just as real, though different, in 4 years, as you are now. And 4 years from now, this baccalaureate day will seem like a barely remembered dream. Proust claims one more thing I want to pass on to you. He says that only when we are reading do we get the full flavor of life's many chapters over time. That is, only then do we get beyond the urgency of the particular chapter we happen to be living. Only when we're reading, he proposes, do we enter the realm of imagination and get through the writer's words that larger sense of what life may be about beyond the present. Whenever I teach this sequence to my students here, they resist. How can their present life, their present real life, not trump any written versions of it, no matter how great the writer? That poor French fool, they go on and think, if they don't say, how alienated he had to be not to know that real life beats anything written in a book. Well, at the risk of appearing perverse, I want to pursue Proust's claim and bring it to bear on your futures. This is my last point, point five. No one here is unfamiliar with the well-known phrase, the real world. You members of the class of 2015 may have been hearing it a great deal this year as your college years draw to a close. It's likely to have been used in a friendly but admonitory way as, get ready now for the real world, or don't expect what comes next, that is, entry into the real world, to resemble the 4 years you've just completed at Swarthmore. On this model, the college, our college, is a rarefied place of privilege, a sort of protected oasis of ventures and adventures that, however wonderful, will not be replicated in the real world. And in a sense, this has to be true. Otherwise, you wouldn't be anxious about leaving. Otherwise, you or your parents would not have borne the extraordinary cost of these 4 years. Something special has to have been happening here that won't happen again. Something wonderful, but also something that the real world will not make available to you. It's surely true that not a one of you seniors expects what comes next to be like what is now ending. And yet the phrase the real world is so impoverished. It's poor in meaning. It assumes that what is real is given, factual, inalterable. Pretending to account for what is objectively there, the phrase leaves you out of the picture. And more, it tends to assume that whatever is not given and neither provable nor proven is unreal. But in your 4 years here, surely one thing many of you have learned is this, that facts are often not facts, and that the given is often the imposed, and that the inalterable can often be altered. More, it has been and is being altered all the time. So the real world, the one we all live in our different ways, is at least as produced as it is given, a world made by labor and passion and imagination, a world imposed or kept as is by power and consent, or power and the incapacity to resist. Though it is often described as how things are, it is again and again how they have been produced. Even when seemingly inalterable, like the institution of the filibuster in the U.S. Senate, what we know is real today was not always so, nor is it fated to remain so. Therefore, the magical moments that lie in store for you, I predict, are those aha moments in which the real world that seemed inalterable tilts, cracks, opens up, shows you something you hadn't seen before about itself or about yourself in it. That's when you see palpably that it was a produced world all the time because you have just breathtakingly revised it or revised yourself, your role in it. Which leads me now to try to put you into the picture. I've said above that being here has contributed to making you more than you were, deeper, cannier, more critical, more creative. Now I'm talking about your being more productive. The master term I want to use for all of these mores is yeasty. You are yeastier than when you arrived 4 years ago. I invite you to think of the real world as a sort of cake that has been and can be baked in countless different ways. It may look like it was always there, unchanged, but it took someone's, some group's input of yeast to make it rise into its present form. That's how I see you at the conclusion of your 4 years, yeastier, more alert to the changeableness of things, more capable of contributing to their change. For 4 years, we've hurled books at you and graphs and paradigms and maps and pictures and theorems and facts, facts, facts. All these ways of showing how the world makes its different kinds of sense and takes on its different kinds of form. All these ways of thinking about how people and peoples have produced this sense and these forms. And you've labored to learn so much of what we've urged upon you in class after class, and you have probably wondered, what does it mean that I've already forgotten a quarter of what I learned this year, a third of what I learned last year, half of, and it goes on. The answer is, I believe it doesn't matter. It's not about remembering what you've learned, it's about learning how to be a learner. It's not about forgetting what you've read, it's about having become a better reader. 25 years ago, none of you seniors was alive then, I spoke to the graduating class of 1990. I urged them to think of themselves not as a noun, but as a verb. To see themselves not as an essence, some achieved thing, but as a practice, a set of capacities. You are what you can do. Not in the narrow sense of what profession you pursue, but in that broad sense of what moves you can make, how you choose to go about the day, the week, the life. An existential psychologist named Rollo May once claimed, "I is the I of I can." As you have become cannier, your eye has become more various, more open, more valuable. You came here not to master the paradigm and then plug it in, but rather to become a cannier practitioner of paradigms. You've not been given the key to anything. but you have learned that the locks are always changing and the keys must change with them. You came here not so much to learn the necessary resources as to learn more about resourcefulness itself. What you have learned here will pay off throughout your lives, not as a what, but as a how, or a why, or a why not. So Proust was right. We need the narratives, the theories, the books, in order to grasp what the real world is actually like, how it came to be what it is. If Swarthmore is an oasis of privilege, then we need this oasis, to take fuller measure of the desert. But Proust was wrong in imagining that books are to life as oasis is to desert. Oppositional terms, nothing in between. The desert was not always the desert. In innumerable ways, it is related to the oasis. Oasis is an enduring possibility of desert. If you've traveled to Israel or to the UAE, you see the desert turning green. Like all the other terms in this talk, and as I learned in surprising ways in the Middle East this past spring, opposites can be more fruitfully seen as hidden and productively in relation to each other. It takes imaginative resourcefulness, not an already learned algorithm, to grasp in what ways the oppositions that you will encounter throughout your lives are potentially implicit in each other, potentially each other's latent partner, not just each other's opposite. So you are the yeasty men and women of the class of 2015. Yeast, however, is useless unless there's going to be some baking. The baking begins unpredictably, often modestly, sometimes magnificently, after you leave these halls. All this has to end so that you can begin to begin again. Thank you.